You're heading south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 63, covering the week of March 13th through March 17th, 2017. Glad to be back on the program. Glad to have you with me. Just want to remind everyone that we exist on your generous contributions alone. So if you like what we do, this podcast, our material on the website, or our programs, head on over to abbevilleinstitute.org, go up to the top of the page, click on support and memberships, and you can make a tax-deductible contribution to the Abbeville Institute. We have various levels to do that. We have monthly options. We have annual options. We have business options. We have all kinds of things for you to help us out. So please do that if you like what we do. Also, follow us on Facebook and Twitter and YouTube. Share this podcast around. Share our material around social media. And I want to remind everyone that our 15th annual summer school is now up. We've posted what we're doing. That will take place July 9th through 14th, 2017 at Seabrook Island, South Carolina. It's always a grand event. It's always a good time. It's highly worth your time to go there. And this particular summer school will talk about the topic of On Being Southern in an Age of Radicalism. So like our other 14 summer schools, this one is an exciting topic, and I think that you'll get a lot out of it. We do have scholarships for students, so if you are a advanced high school student or a college undergraduate or graduate student, head on over to our webpage. The event is in the middle of the page or so. Click on that, and you'll see how to get in contact with Dr. Livingston to apply for a scholarship, but also how to sign up for the summer school as well if you're interested. So we'd love to see you out there. We always have a good time at these summer schools, and we have a great faculty again, as we always do. So please consider thinking about going over to our summer school. Okay, so we had a lot of stuff this week. It was the Calhoun birthday week, so we had a couple of pieces on John C. Calhoun, and then we had some other pieces devoted to the Southern tradition or Southern political or religious or philosophical leaders. So we started off the week with a wonderful piece by Karen Stokes, and it covers Robert Louis Dabney and his philosophy. So if you don't know who Robert Louis Dabney was, he was a great Southern theologian who served during the War for Southern Independence and was a Presbyterian. He wrote a number of books, including A Defense of Virginia, The Life and Campaigns of Lieutenant General Thomas J. Stonewall Jackson, and also a book entitled Practical Philosophy. And the great thing about Dabney, and we've talked about him before on this program, is that his ideas went beyond mere theology. He had a number of things to say about politics, about education, about the isms, as Ms. Stokes points out, in society in the 19th century and what those were going to do. And so what she's done here very nicely is give us several quotations by Dabney and on these various topics. And of course, when you read these things, you get the idea that Dabney was so prescient. He understood what was going to happen moving forward as these isms started to take over. And we've talked about that on this program before. You know, people like Augusta Jane Evans was saying the same things in her book, St. Elmo. But there were many Southern thinkers who understood that if the North won the war, it would open a Pandora's box that could never be closed. And that Pandora's box did not just include the ideas of the day, but various ideas that were germinating in the 19th century, but would not come to fruition until the 20th. And so as Dabney said, quote, "American conservatism is merely the shadow that follows radicalism as it moves forward towards perdition. It remains behind it, but never retards it, and always advances near its leader." Now, that's a wonderful statement, because what we have in the modern age, really, is that very thing. We have conservative leaders who are afraid to really be conservative leaders, and what they've done is become, leftist light. And so progressivism has taken over both parties. And it's not really something that you really can say we have a conservative party in America anymore. So Dabney was pointing that out in the 19th century. He talks about how schools are becoming infused with quote-unquote Yankee ideas. He says, quote, "Your free schools, like not a few of the other pretensions of radicalism, are in fact exactly opposite to the name falsely assumed. The great bulk of those who pay the money for them do it not freely but by compulsion. They are virtually thrust down our throats by the bayonet. And the exemplars you most boast and imitate not only make the payment compulsory, but the attendance also. The only freedom of your system is your freedom to compel other people's money." So this idea of compulsory public education was born in Germany and, of course, foisted on the United States and in the 19th century. Now, Jefferson had his own vision of free public schools, but it was a lot different than what we have today. He was, of course, Dabney was very coarse critical of feminism, as was Augusta Jane Evans. And this is what he said about republican government. He said, quote, "While the Bible does not prohibit stronger forms of government per se, it indicates God's preference for the representative republic as distinguished from the leveling democracy. And to this theory of human rights, all its moral teachings correspond." And so he's critical of this, you know, again, this leveling influence that was going on in America, equality with a capital E, in the 19th century. And he thought this was going to undermine traditional America, traditional American institutions. So it's important to note that Dabney was, again, way ahead of his time in the middle of the 19th century. He died in 1898. So he lived long enough to see the Gilded Age and what it had become, and of course, progressivism in the Gilded Age, in the progressive era. But he did not see it take hold of the American system, the American political system and social system, like it did in the 20th century. But he understood what was at stake. And so it's important to read Dabney and understand him for not just his positions on theology, but also because of what he said about society in the 19th century. On Tuesday, we ran a piece by yours truly entitled "A Deep Devotion to the Constitution." And this particular piece is about John C. Calhoun. And so what I wanted to do, and actually I took all the quotations in this piece from Clyde Wilson's The Essential Calhoun. And if you don't have a copy of that book, you should get it. It was actually, the introduction was written by Russell Kirk. And we ran a piece on Kirk last week. And what Kirk understood is that Calhoun was really an original thinker. He was an important part of American conservatism. And so what I did with this piece is just talk about several of his positions, most importantly on the executive branch, his ideas on foreign policy, and also on duty. You can't really understand Calhoun without understanding his ideas on duty. And what we see with Calhoun is a cogency. Calhoun was the same in 1811 as he was in 1848 or 1850 when he died. He had the very same positions. Calhoun was always a unionist. This is something that working with Clyde Wilson, like I did as a graduate student, led me to understand. And it's that Calhoun that has been lost to modern historiography. Everyone looks at John C. Calhoun as a sectionalist. He was just interested in the South. But Calhoun said his entire life he was interested in the Union of the Founders, which was a union that benefited and burdened all states equally. That was the true general welfare in the Constitution. And so we see sectionalism in the United States. It's in the North. It was disguised as nationalism. And, you know, when you look at Calhoun the nationalist in the early 19th century, what you find is that Calhoun was actually interested in the Union. He was willing to forego Southern interests, for example, his support of the Tariff of 1816 and his support of the Bonus Bill, in the spirit of the Union. But what he figured out is that the North was never willing to reciprocate that goodwill. And so when you look at someone like Daniel Webster the ardent nationalist, supposedly, Daniel Webster was always a sectionalist. During the War of 1812, he supported the secession of New England, or at least nullification. He then became a nationalist when he realized that national programs benefited New England. And so Calhoun, as a young nationalist, was saying, you know what, these ideas, this bonus bill is going to benefit the Union, all the Union. And it will burden the Union equally. All the states will pay for it. The tariff of 1816 was a mild protective tariff, more of a revenue-producing tariff. but he saw this as a way to throw the North a bone. They had been abused by the War of 1812, and so here was a way to help the North out after that war which destroyed their commerce, and of course the embargo from the Jefferson administration and Madison administration had caused a serious harm to their commercial interests. So Calhoun, in the spirit of union, was willing to throw down the interests of the South for the good of the whole. And of course, as I said, that was not reciprocated. So you could even say that Calhoun's unconstitutional positions here were done within the spirit of the Constitution, which was the general welfare of the Union. Now, I think you can look at those and say, yeah, there is a little bit of inconsistency here. But regardless, it's important to understand Calhoun's political philosophy. He also was, of course, very critical of the imperial presidency. And he wrote that the presidency was going to become problematic in the future, not because of the presidency itself, but because of the Congress, which was going to keep punting its constitutional responsibilities to the executive branch. And we'll get into that with one of the other pieces this week. So they play off each other in that way. But Congress, he said, was the real culprit in this particular process. It wasn't the executive branch itself. It was naturally going to take more power if Congress allowed that to happen. So Calhoun, again, was prescient in this way, that the president is going to become essentially an elected monarchy only because Congress is going to let that happen. He also was cogent and consistent in his ideas on foreign policy. He was very critical of the American empire. He believed that the empire was not what the United States should be advancing, that we should be interested in sweeping our own back porch and not worry about what everybody else was doing, that imperialism was not the American foreign policy. So he said the same things in 1811 and in the 1840s. He was, of course, consistent in his advocacy of federalism. And this idea that the federal union, the fourth leg of federalism, or the fourth leg of American government, which was the states, was essential in arresting executive abuse, congressional abuse. So if we didn't have quote-unquote state rights, we would not have a real American government. We needed the states to ensure that the entire system worked. And this was how the founding generation sold the entire system. It's just been abused. It was being abused in Calhoun's time. It was being abused after Calhoun died, and it's being abused today. And he said the same things in 1824 that he said in 1850. It's amazing how consistent Calhoun actually was throughout his life. So, and then there was his sense of duty. Again, he said the same things in his early life that he did just 2 years before he died. He said that, I'm going to read these quotes because they're so good. He said, quote, "All know that in the short time I have been in public service, I have ever stood obstinate against all local party or factious interest, that I often advocated unpopular questions from a brief belief of their utility. I love just renown, but to me, undeserved popularity has no charms." He wrote that in 1811. And then in 1848, he wrote this, quote, "Far higher motives than success impel me, a sense of duty to do our best for our country and leave the rest to Providence. Indeed, I regard this life very much as a struggle against evil, and that to him who acts on proper principle, the reward is in the struggle more than in victory itself. So strong is my faith in this belief that no appreciation of my efforts, either by the present or after times, is necessary to sustain me in struggling to do my duty in resisting wrong, especially where our country is concerned." He also said in that very same letter to his daughter that he loved renown, but the principle was more important. He said the same thing in 1811 as he did in 1848. Nothing changed in 30 years, and it was that sense of duty and that one part, the reward is in the struggle more than in victory itself. And I think this goes back to this republicanism of the founding generation. Duty, honor, having those things that were so important, particularly for Southerners like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and the leaders of the Southern founding, they understood this republicanism more, or in a different way, I should say, than Northerners. It wasn't this kind of half-baked republicanism you get out of the North. The Southern republicanism was very much tied into these Roman concepts of duty and honor. And so Calhoun was very much part of that tradition, and you can't get around it. You can't get around Calhoun's immense dedication to the original Constitution and the founding generation. He said it. He said, look, I am a byproduct of Jefferson and Madison and Monroe. I believe in the principles of 76 and 98. He said this constantly. So Calhoun is, in so many ways, you know, head and shoulders above everyone else of his generation. He was an original thinker. He wasn't just someone who regurgitated some other person's political philosophy. He had his own. And I think that's one reason why we should study Calhoun. Of course, everyone used to study Calhoun. Even John Kennedy thought he was great. And I mentioned that in the beginning of the piece, but it's just modern historians of the left, these social justice warriors who call Calhoun a racist and think his only contribution to American history is slavery and a defense of slavery and a defense of racism. But Calhoun was a much deeper thinker than any of that. And so we should continue to study Calhoun, and people all over the world do study Calhoun. So in this particular week, as we're focusing on Calhoun, it's important to understand who Calhoun was. On Wednesday, we ran a little piece, The South's Gonna Do It Again. This actually came from Southern Partisan Magazine in 1982, and it was written by Tom Fleming, the great Tom Fleming of Chronicles Magazine, who at one time was the editor of Southern Partisan Magazine in the early 80s, one of the founders of the magazine with Clyde Wilson. And, of course, now he has the Fleming Foundation, so if you don't know about that, I think it's flemingfoundation.org. Head on over there and take a look at what he's doing nowadays. But this particular piece is interesting because it could have been written this year. It could have been written in 2017 because what he's talking about is this kind of pushback against the establishment in 1982. And in 1982, it was coming from Southerners like Charlie Daniels and Leonard Skinner, from Hank Williams. It was music that was leading this revolution, so to speak. And many people were listening to these tunes that were speaking of some type of underlying rebellion taking place in America, this blue-collar, blue-jean rebellion. And he was pointing out in 82 that a lot of Southerners were forgetting who they were, and they were aligning themselves with country club Republicans in the North. It was more about class than it was section. But for a lot of people, that was changing. Now, unfortunately, it didn't last. This regionalism and this regional identity of the late 70s and early 80s went away. But this is why the Abbeville Institute exists, to try to keep this thing alive. And he says, you know, look, people understand that the political class is betraying them. This was 1982 that he was saying this. And of course, this is exactly what happened in 2016 with the election of Donald Trump. Now, is Trump going to follow through and do what he said and drain the swamp and clean out corruption and get rid of the political class? It doesn't look like he's doing much of that at the moment. And of course, Ronald Reagan had the same promises back in 1980 when he was elected in 1980 as president, but he didn't do much of that either. So it's very hard to drain the swamp. And I think what Fleming is pointing out here is that, you know, it's not really going to come from the president. We're not going to get it. He does say, if some sort of social revolution does take place in this country, it will not be made by discontented Chicanos, alienated radicals, or country club Republicans. It will come from the dispossessed ordinary Americans of the South, West, and Midwest. The plain Southern folks have more than once in the past demonstrated their ability to make trouble. So he's saying that this grassroots revolution, so to speak, is going to come out of working class Americans. And only when they realize that politics is not their salvation. We see it all the time. I'm going to give all kinds of money to the Republican Party, we're going to change the world. Well, the Republicans never do anything, and that's why they've been called the stupid party. It's why we've talked about the Republican Party on this podcast. It's why we should avoid working with the Republican Party at all costs when we can, because they have never been interested in the South. So this is not new. I mean, when you read something from 30 years ago, over 30 years ago now, we're looking at 35 years ago, when it was said that the Republican Party was not our savior then. The Republican Party is not our savior now. And again, a piece that could have been written this year shows you how little has changed and what people do. It's almost insanity what Southerners do. They keep voting for Republicans and they keep getting disappointed. They need to think about other options and other ways of arresting this very nasty Leviathan that has taken hold of the United States. And it's going to be blue-collar people that do it in the South. So the South's going to do it again. More or less, the blue-collar people are going to do it again. And then on Thursday, we ran a piece by James McClellan, who was a founder of the Abbeville Institute. He was friends with Mel Bradford and Russell Kirk. He was the director of publications for Liberty Fund, and he wrote several important works on American political philosophy. He died in 2005, unfortunately. It was an untimely death. But he wrote a review of Forrest MacDonald's The American Presidency, An Intellectual History, in 1994. And again, you read this, and you see that nothing much has changed. In 20 years, here we are almost 25 years after this particular piece was written, and the American presidency has gotten bigger and stronger, and MacDonald was pointing out where all this came from. Now, I wrote a book along these lines entitled Nine Presidents Who Screwed Up America and Four Who Tried to Save Her. And actually, McClellan points out that the last really good Southern president was John Tyler. He's my number one. John Tyler was the best president in American history, according to the Constitution as ratified. But what MacDonald does in this particular book, you should go out and get it, is trace the intellectual origins of the executive branch. And the first part of the book is just fantastic. He draws heavily on his quite extensive understanding of the 18th century, of political philosophy that extends beyond the United States, and where this stuff came from. And so he is such a treasure, such a jewel. Forrest MacDonald, of course, he died last year, and he was such an important part of American history, in the study of American history, and his works on Hamilton and Washington and Jefferson, on the Constitution, and he was a Hamiltonian. I mean, he said that to the end of his life, and that's one knock we could say against Forrest MacDonald. But he wrote a very good book on the presidency of Thomas Jefferson, for example. He understood the Jeffersonian tradition better than most, and so I think that if you're looking for somewhere to go in 18th century American history in the founding period, go read Forrest MacDonald. You won't be disappointed. So this particular review gets into the idea that the executive branch is off the rails. And as I just mentioned with Calhoun, McClellan says it, look, the Congress has been creating that bureaucracy, and that's allowed the president to extend its unconstitutional power. If it wasn't for the Congress, you wouldn't have this problematic American presidency. So it's important to understand that the president can't function alone. Congress has been a culprit in the process, though the president has been doing things on his own that have definitely strengthened the executive branch at the expense of the states, the Congress, and the federal judiciary. So this is a wonderful little review, highly worth your time to go out and read it. It's highly worth your time to go out and read Forrest MacDonald's book. We do talk about books on this program that you should go get to increase your knowledge and understanding, not only of Southern history, but American history. And as we said over and over again, American history really is the South. The South is America, particularly in the founding period. And as McClellan points out, the South dominated the American presidency up until 1865. And the South dominated the general government. The South dominated the federal judiciary. But that has not been the case. One thing he does say, and this actually piggybacks on something we did last week with the piece on H.L. Mencken, was that the New South is really taking over in America in a lot of ways. But that New South is not the same thing as the Old South, and Southerners have forgotten about who they are, that they at one time had a real aristocratic tradition, and the best presidents came out of that aristocratic tradition in the South. That you have to have that to have these disinterested statesmen. We get bad people, and the people that aren't really worthy of being president because we have this very leveling spirit in America, this dumbed-down spirit of equality with a capital E, and that produces presidents who are not really noteworthy. Would the Bushes have been anything important if it wasn't for the presidency? Absolutely not. Would Barack Obama have been anyone important if it wasn't for the presidency? No. How about Bill Clinton? No way. How about Jimmy Carter? No. Ronald Reagan may have been talked about because he was an actor, but that's the only reason. Donald Trump would have been talked about because he was a celebrity in the 1980s, and he made a lot of money. So there might have been, he wrote books. So people might have talked about Donald Trump 100 years from now. So that might be the exception. But when you look back through American history, particularly in the 20th century, the people that became president are only great because they were president. They didn't do anything substantial before that. Look at Harry Truman. The guy was a haberdasher. And the only reason he became anything is because he got involved in politics. So we have these people that would have been nothing without the government. And yet they become, powerful people. People would say that's a good thing. You can be a nobody and become president. But on the other hand, you produce a class of people that abuse power, that crave power. Politics becomes a job in and of itself. And we have a situation where those who get into office don't ever want to leave because they have nothing to go back to. George Washington could go back to his farm. Thomas Jefferson could go back to his farm. So could Madison and Monroe. John Tyler could go back to Sherwood Forest. These people had something else besides the executive branch. And I think that's something you can say about Donald Trump. He could just go back to his businesses when he's out of office. What is Barack Obama going back to? Nothing. He moves into Washington, D.C. After he leaves, moves into a house in Washington, D.C., and he runs a shadow government there because that's all Barack Obama is. His whole entire life is politics. George W. Bush had interests outside of that, so he's gone back to painting and his ranch and these other things. But still, he was governor of Texas, but he wouldn't really have been anything without politics. And I think you can say that about most people in the 20th century in the executive branch. So it's interesting to see how the office has changed because American society has changed and because of what we expect out of the presidency. And so when you get to the piece on Friday, Coits Calhoun, written by Clyde Wilson. Look, we're going to have a week about Calhoun. You got to have a piece by Clyde Wilson. And so this is a nice little. I asked him to review Margaret Coits' John C. Calhoun American Portrait, which is still the best biography of John C. Calhoun, unless you want to go back through and read all the introductions to the Calhoun papers that Clyde wrote over the years, or the introduction to his Essential Calhoun, which I mentioned in this podcast already. But as far as a full-length treatment, Coit did a wonderful job. In fact, won the Pulitzer Prize for biography in 1951. And this made everyone stand up and rethink John C. Calhoun, this great American that John F. Kennedy thought was a great American. Of course, Kennedy was not afraid to be pictured with a Confederate battle flag, as most politicians are today. And there's plenty of pictures out there with him with one across the South when he was campaigning for president. As Clyde says, Coit's book has not changed and is still a marvelous correction to presently distorted history, as well as a stellar example of the biographer's art. You should go out and read Margaret Coit's Calhoun. But this is more than that. This piece, it's Clyde Wilson's John C. Calhoun. And he mentions things. Calhoun was a statesman. He took a long-range view of the best interests of his society, even when it was unpopular, one who was intellectually and morally superior to a politician. That's what Calhoun was. And as I mentioned, this is what I said in my piece as well, through quotations from Clyde's Essential Calhoun. Clyde says, was not just a public man, but a political philosopher. He resembled the founding fathers more than his own or later generations. Coit was, of course, a New Englander, but she loved John C. Calhoun. She lived much of her life in Massachusetts. And if this woman from Massachusetts can admire John C. Calhoun, maybe we can too. What Coit does more than anything else, is, as Clyde says, is discover the real Calhoun, a handsome man of charm and integrity who won the respect of army officers, frontiersmen, and hard-fisted labor leaders, and even unwilling young abolitionists. So Calhoun was so well respected that everyone recognized his greatness at the time. It's just we've been so distorted by social justice that we can't see it anymore. But Calhoun is one of the greatest Americans in American history. If Americans were actually being honest about their history, they would put Calhoun up there in the pantheon of great American political leaders, great American statesmen, great American men. And so as we look at Calhoun's birthday, one thing we have to do as we think about exploring what's true and valuable in the Southern tradition is doing just what Calhoun said we should do. The struggle is more important than the victory. And here we are in the struggle to maintain this real American history, this struggle to maintain what the South was to America and understand what it provided, which was the best that America ever produced. And so if we can continue to do that, if we can continue to understand what Southern culture is, what the Southern political tradition is, and all of these things that make the South great, we will be better off in the future and better off in the long run. And that's what we're trying to do here at the Abbeville Institute, is explore what's true and valuable in the Southern tradition and ensure that that tradition is maintained for future generations. And articles on Calhoun will do that, on Dabney, on the American presidency, on the Southern musical tradition. All of these things are important, put together to help us remember who we are, as Mel Bradford said. We need to remember who we are. And so as you think about the Southern tradition, think about the Abbeville Institute. Think about what we do. Attend our summer schools. Help us do this financially. These are important things. The struggle is important. We may not win every battle, and we're not going to. And this is a long war. We may lose a lot more than we win. But we're going to be here. And the internet is the great leveling, if you want to talk about leveling, it is the great leveling spirit because it allows these ideas to percolate and spread across America. So join the tens of thousands of people who are involved in this particular movement to explore what's true and valuable in the Southern tradition. Until next time, good day. Thank you.